It was a guy named Bill McIntyre. He was working for National Public Radio. He had just come. I opened the door finally and said, "What do you want?" And he explained to me who he was. He said he had just come from the Black Hills of South Dakota, and that he had been sent there by the Sioux Indians, who had read an article that I had written originally back in prior to this incident, and that they were very concerned because Honeywell Corporation, which is one of the companies that was testing the depleted uranium in Socorro, there was many companies, Honeywell was one, had bought a piece of property in the Black Hills from some ranchers, large amount of property, and that they were going to test depleted uranium there, and they were going to leave the Black Hills clean. They told the Indians, Sioux Indians, that they were going to leave it cleaner than they found it, and that there would be no problem. And this Bill McIntyre had been sent to Socorro by the, not necessarily just the Indians who were protesting this, but also the leaders of the Indian tribes from that part of the country, of the state, or not the state, the country, somewhere even from Canada. There was a huge amount of people that were going to meet in some 3 or 4 weeks down the road. And he asked me, he said that they had sent him to Socorro to convince me to go to South Dakota to speak to these councils before them, to tell them what I knew about this depleted uranium, because they had to make they didn't know what they were going to do about this issue. So I went there to the Black Hills of South Dakota. There I found some 90 warriors. They had camped right on the road that the Honeywell had dug a trench or a road to get into the Black Hills with a big tractor. And there they camped so nobody could go in there. There was a big tractor there that they had bladed the road with. And that tractor went over a cliff one day. Somebody started it up, got it going, and sent it over a cliff. These people meant business, and they were armed. At night, cars would come and they'd spotlight. They wouldn't come in the daytime, but at night there would be cars come out there and they'd spotlight the cars that we had out there. I asked these people that I was with, these Sioux Indians, who that might be, and they said, "It's the FBI." I didn't know. What do I know?
Okay, and this was in,
1989. And I don't know that I want to get into some of the ceremonies that they put me through, the Native Americans, but I went through some ceremonies and some cleansing ceremonies. They wanted to prepare me before I went to speak to these councils in Pierre, South Dakota. I was in Hot Springs, South Dakota. I spent about 3 weeks with them, and finally the time came to go to Pierre. I told them everything I knew, and they went into session. There was many of them. They had a whole floor of the Holiday Inn and a huge, huge space there where they had their meeting. And they went into council and came back and asked me to speak again. They had a question for me, and they asked me what I would recommend. And I told them that they should oppose this enterprise that Honeywell had at all cost, and they should make that clear to the press. The press was there. A lot of press was waiting to find out what they were going to do. And that's what I said. And when they went down to the press conference, that's exactly what they told the press. I went back to Socorro, and some 4 weeks later, I pick up a copy of Newsweek. Honeywell kicked out of the Black Hills of South Dakota. And I felt so, so good, like I did today, when the hung jury came in for the Grady's, and the people involved in the trial here in Ithaca, New York. It's not, you don't win many victories against the nuclear lobby, the defense lobby, and the Pentagon. But we won that victory there, and then today I witnessed another victory. Even though they were not acquitted, it was a hung jury. That's, in my opinion, we don't get that far in most of these types of cases. And so I was so happy, and I knew that it was possible that little people can do something with their lives, and that these big lobbies don't always win. And so I've always had all these years, I've always had faith that justice prevails. I've seen two victories now and been a part of them. Here at this particular trial that took place, or the judge has sent them back to reconsider their judgment. I doubt that the jury is going to change their mind about this hung jury. It's a rare thing for something like this to happen. And I believe things are changing and can change. That people can make changes in this world.
So, as far as you could tell from the documents that you originally obtained from the weapons facility there, people have now been exposed to depleted uranium possibly for 3 decades. Yes?
Yes.
1973, they were doing the testing.
That was in Socorro, and mm-hmm. quite possibly this testing could have been taking place prior to that in other facilities. Later on, I wrote a major report that was released in 1993 called Uranium Battlefields at Home and Abroad, the Use of Depleted Uranium by the U.S. Department of Defense. And I got a co-author, Grace Brukowski, to write it with me. And took all those documents that we had, and this was after the Gulf War, and released this report in Washington, D.C. This report made headlines, not just in the United States, but many other places, particularly the Arab states. Iraq picked up a copy of this report, and they were, at the time, this was 1993, they were quite concerned about unusual birth defects and diseases and cancers that were starting to erupt in that country. And when they saw this report, Uranium Battlefields, they began epidemiological studies in that country, many of them. And before, you know, they had the data, health data, obviously, before the Americans attacked them. And after the Gulf War, this information, these studies, they did studies, and they continued doing studies until, I suppose, since this most recent invasion. My organization has those studies in our website, www.idust.org. In 1998, the Iraqi Ministry of Health invited me to Iraq to be in a panel for a big conference they had on depleted uranium, and I was able to see firsthand what problems people were experiencing, particularly young children with birth defects, very rare birth defects. And what's interesting is some of those rare birth defects are the same rare birth defects that we've been having in Socorro and had in Socorro prior to my going to Iraq.
Tell me about what you some of those were, and
sure.
Compare like what
okay.
you saw.
Sure. Well, one of the things, going back to 1986, when I learned that they were testing these weapons there, I thought, well, you know. When I knew it was depleted uranium, I thought, well, let's see if there's any problem, health problems in the community. environmental problems. Well, I thought I'll get anecdotal information first. So I started looking around, asking questions. Seemed like cancer was something that everybody was well aware of. Many people were getting cancer in that community, and leukemia. And then I noticed some of my cousins, some of them had six digits on their feet, cleft lips, split lips. They were born with them. And then what really got my attention was some cases of hydrocephalus.
What is that?
Hydrocephalus is when a child is born with a large head and has water in the brain. The child does not live a normal life in terms of its lifespan. Very rare disease. I begun to do, after looking at the anecdotal information, you know, this is what people said, and I saw a couple of these children. And so I went to the state health department years later, and I was able to document something. The state health department, they had records of some of these hydrocephalus cases in the state of New Mexico and Socorro, and it turned out that between the years 1983, I believe, and 1988, a 5-year period, in the state of New Mexico, which is 1.5 million people, they had had 19 cases of hydrocephalus in the entire state. 3 of those cases came from Socorro, a little town of 7,000 people. That was alarming. That was too much. We were getting too many cases compared to other places in the state.
And did this hold true with other types of birth defects, you know, multiple digits, cancers? Were you able to obtain any statistics like that comparing Socorro to other places?
Yes. I went to the mayor of the community, and I told him, you know, we really ought to look at these cancer cases and see if we really have a problem with cancer. I knew we had a problem with hydrocephalus because I got this information. 3 out of 19 cases in a community that small, there's something wrong here. Something is wrong. And so there was a study done that was that the mayor of the town, it ended up New Mexico Tech, the same people who did the testing, did the study, and on cancer rates. But what happened was I saw an unusual spike, and it was basically the same years that the hydrocephalus cases had come up. I saw a huge spike in cancer mortality rates over a period of years. And that was also quite alarming. And for me, this combination led me to believe that there was something very seriously going on in that community in terms of health effects, and that there may be a cause and effect between the testing of this uranium weapons, radiation weapons, and these illnesses in Socorro. And
is this still going on, by the way, this testing of uranium weapons in Socorro?
They said that they stopped testing these weapons in 1993. And this was at a forum in the community on this depleted uranium. I helped bring about some conferences and people together, and including the people from the health department. Even though they wouldn't do studies, they did hold some hearings. And there, the person who was responsible for this facility,
is that Latin
Van Romero? No, this guy's name is Van Romero, one of the vice presidents, and he was in charge of this Terra project. He said that they had stopped testing the weapons in 1993, and I said, well, you know, I have documents here from the Army Environmental Policy Institute saying that their 120-millimeter shells are being tested here and were tested there in 1995. And I also have some documents here from Alien Tech System dated 1986 or 1996. And they claim they're also testing these weapons there at least the year before, which was 1995. And they didn't say nothing. Later, in an interview with a Taos newspaper, I mentioned this same thing. And so when they were doing the story, they contacted this Van Romero again and said, when did you stop testing this depleted uranium in Socorro? It's a straight question. And he said, 1995. Today, there's these booms. We hear maybe 15, 20, sometimes as many as 40 explosions. Some are huge and are still going on to this very day. I live in Socorro now, or at least I spend about 2 or 3 months a year there in Socorro. I try not to stay there too long. But these explosions continue. And I've approached them many times and ask them if they're still testing these weapons, and they continue to say what they have said before, is they haven't tested anything since 1993. They don't handle the uranium. They're not putting anything together. There's none of their contractors are doing this. That everything is fine and there's no problem.
Have any of the residents of Socorro been tested for uranium in their bodies?
To my knowledge, none of them have. We tried to get the state health department, the epidemiology office of the state health department. Twice they were asked, myself, I asked them, I was an official in Socorro with the city government, asked them to come into Socorro and do baseline studies to find out what the health of the people were. Later we asked for an epidemiological study. They refused to do them each time. The reason for doing it was that those clouds of smoke and the radiation did not come into the community, that it went to the border. There's a fence there that borders the city from the testing facility, and that when the radiation got to this fence, it didn't cross it. Yeah, it stopped. It came down. It was very heavy, and it couldn't go into the community. That was their reason for not coming into town and checking the people. And I was hoping that they would check.
That sounds ridiculous. They said this to you with a straight face?
In a letter, an official letter from the state epidemiologist.
Has anyone taken ground samples of ground in the community and had those analyzed for radioactivity?
Well, you know, that's interesting you asked that. Later, I asked that I asked the governor of New Mexico. At one point there, it was 1987, I asked the governor, a new governor in New Mexico, if they would do a baseline study of depleted uranium in the soil and water. And to my surprise, the governor agreed to do this. And those studies were done. And in my jacket here, I have a copy. They found contamination, soil contamination, water contamination in that area, in their work. They went on to say that, that was to be expected because they were testing this depleted uranium there, and that this was not unusual that this contamination exists there at the test site. And they recommended that this test be done every year after that. So a couple of years after that, I went back and asked them for the results of the tests that they had, they themselves had suggested this be a good baseline, they should do it each year. And I went to the Environment Department, to the person in charge of this project, and he said, he couldn't even remember that they had even done a baseline study, and that nothing else had been done since. When I showed him the baseline study, which is here, that was a letter that was sent to me, but here's the study. This is the first page. Of course, they talk about the contamination of the soil, the water, and the samplings that they had done.
A study called the Terra and Socorro Soil and Water Sampling and Analysis, and it is signed by, is that Michael J. Burkhart,
Michael
Director?
J. Burkhart.
Is this the New Mexico Department of Health and Environment, dated January 27th, 1988?
One of the things that they said in that report, it's a conclusion. It says, since these data are measurable through laboratory analysis, and since sites for sampling are recorded and mapped, this information delineates a good baseline for future sampling of soil and water during active TERRA programs and after closure of activities. I have a letter here that I am going to be sending to Governor Bill Richardson, who is now the governor of New Mexico, used to be the secretary of the Department of Energy, also used to be a representative for the state of New Mexico, asking. Today, this letter says, today I ask that a baseline study be repeated to ensure that cleanup has taken place, because not only did they say they stopped testing, but that they cleaned it up. And so I'm sending this study to the governor as soon as I get back to New Mexico and ask them to go back and check it to make sure that it is clean, and the reason for the baseline was in case they stopped the testing. So I'm asking them if they will do that. If they will repeat that study, just that was, according to them, that was the reason why they did this baseline.
Okay, is this issue in the forefront of the attention of the residents in Socorro? Are they, you know, has this like died down, or are they living in continual fear of this, or what is the situation there now?
The people in Socorro. Socorro, New Mexico is a very sparse state. It's a lot of land and few people. And the people in Socorro, particularly the Hispanic population, Native American population, have been in that area for a very long time. And their homes are there. Their family history comes from there. It's ancestral land to many people. At first, they were very, very angry about what had happened. But once they realized what the problem was, they got very quiet, you know, and I think they were quite afraid that, you know, if this indeed was a big health problem for them, and they had to leave the town, they didn't feel like they could change anything. That, like me, you know, looking at all this lobby and these nuclear and defense industry and the Pentagon, they begin to see the same thing. And the people, after a couple, 2 or 3 years, begin to, look at their options. And they didn't feel like they had much hope in changing anything. So they seem to be, try to ignore the explosions that go off, even though they're huge. People do not speak about depleted uranium in Socorro anymore. They stay very quiet. They say very little about this. And they seem to just pretend nothing's going on. But the people in Socorro are well aware of what's going on. It's just that they don't feel like they have any other options. That's what the impression that I get from the community. Both the business people and the people who have been there for a very long time, the business people, if they acknowledge this problem and this radiation in the community, then they have businesses. They sell real estate. They have hotels. They got restaurants. Who wants to come to a place that's contaminated? And as I said earlier, the people who live in the community, if they have to move away from there, to them that's not an option. There's a strange denial that's taken place in that community. As I said, very rarely will anybody say anything about depleted uranium in that community.
And does the cancer continue to increase?
The cancer continues to increase. I know people who work at the hospital, not just the cancers, there's stillborn children, it's fairly high. I've only been back in Socorro now for 2 years. I myself try to stay low-keyed in that community. I have just gone back after all these years, since 1989. And so I'm very concerned about my own safety, even at this time. And I still follow the advice that the attorneys gave me in the past, is not to be out after dark by myself. Frankly, I feel that I'm in danger in that community, not necessarily just from the depleted uranium, but from the people who promote this kind of activity.
So what is your organization doing now?
Well, last May, in Brussels, Belgium, we pulled together people from many different countries for a conference there in Berlaar, Belgium. And out of that 3-day conference, a new coalition was born. It's called the International Coalition to Ban Uranium Weapons. This group is a group which includes people from many different countries throughout the world that are concerned about this issue. This group is meeting again on May the 5th. I will be going back to Brussels. And their goal is to ban the use of depleted uranium in military weapons or uranium in weapons. And they are making progress. And I believe that it's going to take some direction. Also, the International Depleted Uranium Study Team, as I mentioned, we're dealing with some of the issues there in Socorro as well, beginning to be more active. But we want to make sure that when we begin that we have our ducks lined up.
Okay.
So I said, you were saying that Mr. Lapman?
Dr. Lapman.
Dr. Lapman is no longer the president of New Mexico Tech.
No. A few years later, right about the time of the Gulf War took place, which was about 1990-91, he was released from his duties as president of New Mexico Tech. And the reason was he caused a real turmoil in that university community. I guess there was some students that had challenged him, having to do with some issue, I think, other than the depleted uranium. And he publicly threatened physical harm to the student, and more than one student. And he was let go. This was about 1991. And then shortly after that, he was put on the governor of New Mexico, put him on the board of the Environment Department, which were the people that were overseeing the activities at New Mexico Tech with the depleted uranium.
And who is in charge of that facility now, do you have an idea?
Dr. Van Romero.
Okay, so the one who gave inconsistent testimony about when the depleted uranium supposedly ceased being used.
Yes.
Okay, so there has been no more recent test of soil? I mean, even done by a private lab or anything?
No. That kind of cost is huge, and if we're going to go back to test the soil there where they did this test, we have to go some of it into the facility. It is prohibited to enter that facility. There are signs around the facility and a fence saying keep out, both in Spanish and in English, that this is government property. Mm-hmm. And it's patrolled by security guards.
What's the next step for you? Depleted uranium obviously is something that is rising out of obscurity into public focus at this time, it seems, more so than in the past. I mean, there have been people who have been focusing on this issue, but the general population is not aware of it, has not been aware of it. Is that your experience?
Yes, the general population is not. Last year, I spent 8 months in Europe in 11 different countries, gave presentations in over 100 cities. Prior to that, I had been on tour here in the United States for about 11 months, went to many states, even gave even more presentations than I did in Europe. What I would ask the public when I would give these lectures and presentations, many to colleges, some to university professors, different people from different walks of life. I would ask the people, how many of them, I'd ask for a raise of hands, how many of them knew about depleted uranium? About 5% of them would raise their hand. While I was in Europe, the percentage doubled. It was more like about 10% of the people there and 5% of the people here in this country. They are not aware of this problem.
Here's a question. How many other towns like Socorro do you think there are in this country?
In that report, Uranium Battlefields at Home and Abroad, the Use of Depleted Uranium by the U.S. Department of Defense, we identified about 50.
50. And,
but different types of activity.
If people are concerned about what might have happened near where they live, if they're in danger from being irradiated, can they visit your site and get information as to where these things are taking place?
Absolutely. www.idust.net. They can get a hold of people in our organization and we will respond to them. All the people of the world should be concerned about this. This is a human rights issue.
Depleted uranium and other radioactivity doesn't stop at national borders nor fence lines, does it?
According to some military sources, it stops there. They say that it just comes down very fast at the border of some of these states. You know, like, there's international laws that prohibit the use of poison. Radioactivity is a poison. When they use this weapon in combat, sometimes they use it in populated areas like Baghdad or Basra, towns in Afghanistan, in Kosovo. There's international laws, very strict ones, about releasing poison in wartime. It's not acceptable, and the United States is a signature to these treaties. Also, you cannot poison civilians, or you can't use weapons that go into neutral countries, to countries that are not participating in the battles. This depleted uranium gets up into the air, and wherever the wind takes it, it goes. And if it's very heavy wind, it goes a very long way. It resuspends with whatever winds come up. The half-life of this depleted uranium is 4.5 billion years.
That's about the same length as there is believed to have been life on this planet, correct?
No, that's about the same amount of time that this planet has been in existence.
So this stuff is poison to the end of the world.
That's it. Los Alamos is a place where over 100 tons of depleted uranium and other uranium products have been expended since the Manhattan Project there at Los Alamos. And they continue to test depleted uranium at this facility. They had a huge fire a few years ago, forest fire, and it went right through the area where the depleted uranium range was, and it went into the area where they had dumped depleted uranium into arroyos nearby, and that uranium burnt for quite a while, several weeks before it finally stopped burning. Right now they have one nuclear dump called WIP, the Waste Isolation Pilot Project, that receives waste from military activities there. They're getting ready in Eunice, New Mexico. They're trying to put together a facility to reprocess uranium enrichment plant. And the byproduct, of course, is the depleted uranium.
Is there anything else you'd like to add or any message you'd like to send to people who may be listening?
I would say to the people out there who are listening to this that they should educate themselves about this. To use radioactive waste and weapons is wrong. I would say to the people, this is not necessarily just my problem. It is the problem of every human being on this earth.
That was Demacio Lopez, Executive Director of the International Depleted Uranium Study Team, IDUST. For more information on depleted uranium or on the work of IDUST, you can visit them on the web at www.idust.net. That's IDUST.net. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse,
W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR, Knoxville. At the beginning of the program, you heard some of the closing arguments from the trial of the St. Patrick's Day 4 peace activists who poured blood at a military recruiting center near Ithaca, New York. The closing statement of Prosecutor Jennifer Worrell included these words.
Now, I'm not going to stand here and tell you that the defendants' beliefs aren't sincere. You can even admire the strength of their convictions and the fact that they're willing to do more than just talk. But you cannot admire what they did that day. You cannot condone it. If you want to admire the way anyone acted that day, admire the way that Sergeant Montgomery and Sergeant Marine acted that day. They simply went to work and had people come in and throw blood around their place of employment, but yet they handled it professionally. Admire the way the police acted that day. They responded to this call and treated the defendants with courtesy.
Is Ms. Worrell for the war? Against the war? As a professional, her personal beliefs are irrelevant and do not enter into her ability to do her job, which is to convict the four peace activists for violating a law. Such an approach is one she urged the jury to admire. It is a mindset that enables one to ask a jury to be outraged that two military recruiting sergeants had their workday disrupted by a pint of blood poured in their office, while ignoring the thousands of gallons of blood collectively on the hands of the military and the leaders of the U.S. government. This outlook demonstrates the central thesis of the book I've been reading installments from since last October, Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives, by Jeff Schmidt. In it, Schmidt has analyzed and challenged the system of training that strives to produce people who will focus narrowly on their tasks and reject engaging the serious ethical and moral questions that form the context of the work they perform. Today we're going to begin the final chapter of the book, Chapter 16, titled Now or Never, that deals with uniting one's beliefs with one's work. Schmidt writes, "You're doing socially significant work. That's one big reason why you wanted to become a professional in the first place, and now you're doing it. However, all is not well. You find that your assignments do little more than service some part of the social structure. It's socially significant work, to be sure, but not in the way you had in mind. You wanted your work to contribute to progress in the social structure, to more equality and democracy, to less hierarchy and authoritarianism. But now you realize that you have been hired to serve as a strut in the very structure you wanted to change. You feel like part of the problem. What do you do? Simply put, you must become a radical professional. That may sound extreme, but it's the only way to be honest to your goals. Your egalitarian aims make you a radical. The fact that your priorities are so different from your employer's priorities is one big hint of that. So there is no easy way out of your predicament at work. Either you sideline your goals, or you are a radical professional. But what exactly is a radical professional? If a radical is someone who undermines authority by developing and propagating new, more democratic ideologies, and a professional is someone who bolsters authority by following assigned ideologies, then what is a radical professional? Clearly, the best definition is not immediately evident, and as a result, the label has been used cavalierly. Experience has taught me to reserve the term radical professional for professionals with three characteristics, each of which is absolutely necessary. Thus, to be a radical professional, 1. Your primary self-identification must be radical, not professional. By my definition, radical professionals are professionals who think of themselves as radicals first, as radicals who happen to be working as professionals, rather than as professionals who happen to be radicals. Individuals who call themselves radical professionals, but who think of themselves as professionals first, are in essence liberals. Such people make the social reform movement unattractive by bringing to it the same elitism, the same inequality of authority, and ultimately the same hierarchy of somebodies and nobodies that turn people off to the status quo in the first place and sparks their interest in the opposition. 2. You must hold a very critical view of the social role of your profession and of the institution that employs you. As a radical professional, you always look beyond the children's story and public relations images of the profession and institution, and see clearly the roles they actually play in society. For example, every time you think of the institution that employs you, you see an institution that plays a particular role in maintaining and reproducing the social structure. As a result, your response to issues that come up at work is always part of a response to the institution's role in maintaining the status quo. You see the contradiction between the institution's work and the work that would be best for society, and you try to do as little of the former and as much of the latter as you can get away with. You don't identify with the institution, and so you speak of it as they, not we. Individuals who call themselves radical professionals, but who identify with the institutions that employ them and see no conflict between what they have been hired to do and what they think should be done, have been neutralized through incorporation into the system. As I explained in Chapter 1, by the system, I mean the social hierarchy. Number 3. Your politics must make a difference in the world. You must make your radical outlook count for something somewhere. It must guide you in some activity on or off the job. The fact that you are a radical makes no difference and is therefore wasted when you do things that would be done anyway. So you must do things that otherwise would not be done. At work, you get little satisfaction when you do essentially the same thing that would be done by a non-radical replacing you. Even when the boss tells you, "Good job," you are not satisfied even if the work is socially beneficial. Yes, it feels nice to be one of those who do some of the socially beneficial work the system orders, but you are truly satisfied only when you do something that increases the total amount of socially beneficial work that is done. You increase this total in many ways. Engaging for making direct contributions yourself by taking extra time to better serve clients and the public while on the job, to fighting for structural changes in the system while off the job. I use the term clients broadly. For teachers, they are students. For journalists, readers. For doctors, patients, and so on. The third point is a subtle one, and failure to understand it takes a toll on the social reform movement. From a global point of view, what matters is not who does work that changes society for the better, but how much of such work is done. Nevertheless, it is understandable that newly graduated professionals who identify not with the system but with the opposition want to be the ones who do this work. However, some feel that they must be the ones to do this work. They feel that unless they get a job with a reform-oriented organization, such as a human rights group, public interest law project, union, alternative media outlet, or political group, that they are not really genuine members of the opposition. Such an assessment is doubly wrong. First, if one has to get hired by the opposition to be a full-fledged member of it, then the opposition is doomed to weakness because it does not and never will employ more than a minute fraction of the workforce. It does not need to, of course. Oppositional organizations get their strength from their active members, not from their office staffs. A union with many truly active members is very strong, even if it employs only a relatively small number of people. Second, many reform-oriented organizations are hierarchically organized, and staff members are basically expected to follow the policy set by those at the top. If, for example, those at the top of a union decide that cooperation with management is the union's new strategy, as happened with the United Auto Workers' Jointness Program, then the union's organizers and other staff members are not free to take a different approach. The problems faced by radical professionals working in such reform-oriented organizations are in essence the same as those faced by radical professionals working for mainstream organizations. When individuals fail to get reform-oriented jobs and instead join the staffs of establishment organizations, as the vast majority must because of the relatively small number of reform-oriented jobs, they often identify with the opposition less and less as time goes by, because they feel they are not a part of it. They fail to see that although it would be personally pleasant to work for a flawless outfit, a willingness to struggle to make an imperfect one better might do the world more good. And so their original assessment that they are not genuine members of the opposition tragically fulfills itself. You can avoid this fate, but as a professional in a mainstream organization, there are tremendous forces acting on you to adopt a more conventional frame of reference, and thereby drift away from the opposition. To remain radical in this situation requires a deliberate and continuing effort. Simply put, you must anchor yourself in the opposition. You must connect yourself with radical organizations. You must subscribe to radical publications. Such connection with the movement for social change, and only such connection with the movement, allows you to work in the system without being of the system. Experience shows that there is simply no other way. So, you're a radical professional. Now, how do you pursue your own vision on a professional job where, in essence, you have been hired to help fulfill someone else's vision? There's no universal technique. Basically, you do as much as you can get away with. Whenever you have the opportunity to influence a decision, you tilt in the direction that advances your larger social goals. You find, however, that even in carrying out the work assigned to you, you can't get away with much out of the ordinary before you're seen as breaking ideological discipline. So you constantly find yourself doing more or less the same thing in more or less the same way as your non-radical co-workers. You simply aren't making much of a difference. Most of the social change that you do introduce isn't really your own doing, but is the result of changes in the larger society to which the institution would soon conform even in your absence. These changes, such as increased attention to minority issues, are brought about through the struggle of independent organizations such as civil rights groups. You soon realize that as far as having an effect on the social structure goes, your entire institutional career is of little value. You can do much more for democratic social progress by participating in the movement for social change and by engaging other independent oppositional activities than through your salaried professional work. Nevertheless, there are many things you can do at work to advance your goals. Below are 33 suggestions. Out of necessity, many are quite radical. I can't say how risky each one is, because that varies greatly from workplace to workplace, some workplaces being more repressive than others. However, your gut feeling about each suggestion probably gives a safe estimate of the risk it carries where you work. In the most repressive workplaces, getting caught even trying the mildest of the suggestions could jeopardize your job, because even the tiniest deviation from, quote, normal behavior can indicate that you have adopted a critical attitude and therefore can't be trusted to uphold an assigned ideology. In my own work experience, I managed to follow most of the suggestions without getting fired. And let me just break in here to say, however, he did get fired after he published this book. How much do you do along the lines of these suggestions? Ranging from nothing at all to as much as you can get away with depends upon how radical you choose to be. The corresponding spectrum ranges from mainstream professional to radical professional. Thus, as a radical professional employed by an established organization, to the extent you can get away with it, you 1. Help coworkers look beyond your employer's public relations image as serving the public. You help them to see the organization for the institution of the status quo that it is, and to understand the particular role it plays in perpetuating the social hierarchy. 2. Encourage coworkers to connect themselves with radical organizations and to read and subscribe to radical publications. You circulate anti-establishment periodicals or selected articles from them to professional and non-professional coworkers who might be interested. 3. Break down discipline to your employer's ideology. You encourage coworkers to take a critical view of the assigned ideology, and you support them whenever they make progressive challenges to that ideology. You win every crumb and token that can be won. 4. Assign your own curiosity. On the job, you develop and pursue your own goals while supposedly pursuing your employer's goals. You steal as much time and as many resources as is possible to do this. You encourage the hiring of more employees to give everyone else more time to pursue their own goals. 6. Overcome your need for the boss's compliments on your work. You judge your work yourself by very different criteria, based on the goals of the oppositional movement to which you are connected. And I'm reading from Discipline Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000, in the final chapter of the book titled Now or Never. Number 6. Give priority during working hours to helping coworkers with their own self-assigned, politically progressive projects. You collaborate on such projects whenever possible. Number 7. Resist taking on extra work or special projects for the bosses unless you will have control over the ideological content of the work. Otherwise, the extra work will simply crowd out your own more socially beneficial projects. Number 8. Channel as much useful information as possible, especially inside information, to opposition groups, publications, and individuals. As someone who was a radical first, you see this as your responsibility. In this and in a number of other activities listed here, you may have to act anonymously to protect yourself from employer reprisals. But acting anonymously does not mean acting alone. That you do only when there is no other way. Anonymously here means acting with as many co-workers as possible, but without management's knowledge. Number 9. Blow the whistle and sabotage projects that are against the public's interest. You act for a fairer social structure even at your employer's expense. You do this, for example, by leaking plans and other information to opposition organizations or to the press. In the case of the press, you make it the radical press not only to avoid an innocuous treatment of the issue, but also to build the radical press. When this activity becomes widespread, all segments of society will see the radical press as required reading. Number 10. Air your institution's dirty laundry in public. When you make public an internal fight over the nature or quality of the institution's products or services, you expose your bosses to pressure that makes an outcome in the public interest more likely, and the usual outcome that serves elites less likely. This pressure can be strong because even members of the public who seem to be apathetic perk up when let in on what's going on behind the scenes. They can see where the decision is being made and can, for a change, imagine themselves influencing it. 11. sharpened general awareness of the political nature of professional work by drawing attention to the specific places in the work where ideology plays a role and where management acts to set the tone. When research scientists claim that their work is politically neutral, I think of the cartoon by Sidney Harris, in which one researcher in a laboratory coat says to another, "If only there was some peaceful use for nerve gas." Even professionals who do liberal political work off the job often fail to recognize that their professional work on the job is just as political, that neither what is done, nor the way it is done, nor the result is neutral or serves universal interests. Hence, you encourage co-workers to reflect critically on the political nature of their work. This is not at all as easy as it sounds. The notion that professional activity and political activity can be thought of separately is very convenient for the liberal professional, because it allows for unfettered career building. When you challenge this notion, you confront the individual's careerism. For scientists, the convenient way of looking at things is that there is nothing inherently political about any particular piece of science, including nerve gas, but that what is political is a completely separate question of whether the piece of science is to be used in a socially beneficial way or to be abused, the piece of science itself being no better suited for one than the other. The career-protecting point of view, known as the use-abuse school of thought, has been discussed and refuted elsewhere. Point number 12. Debunk the myth of the objectivity or neutrality of the profession and its working principles. You challenge the social role of the profession. Number 13. Encourage co-workers to see it as their business to pass judgment on the ideological content of their work assignments and not just to accept the assigned ideology uncritically. You encourage informal workplace discussions without managers to critique the ideological content of the work at hand. You want these discussions to become the locus of the most lively, interesting, unrestrained, uncensored, honest, free-flowing, and democratic debates about the content of the work. Such discussions will prepare people to work in concert for common goals during the repressed discussions of work content that take place at the official staff meetings run by management. You strive to make the non-management discussions regular and formal and inclusive of non-professionals. In most workplaces, this would be a very bold move. And I've been reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives, written by Jeff Schmidt and published in the year 2000 by Roman and Littlefield. I'm now in the final chapter of the book, titled Now or Never. This last chapter deals with how to be a radical professional, what it is, and what you can do while working inside the system to further progressive social goals. We're out of time for this week. We'll continue more with this chapter in the next reading. If you'd like to find out more about Disciplined Minds or its author, Jeff Schmidt, who, as I said, was fired from his job after writing this book, you can visit www.disciplinedminds.com. And to contact us here on the program, visit unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
The rich will come down.